Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God now. We were talking about a number of things earlier today on other shows. We've got a number of topics that we've been rolling along with. What's this church thing? I can tell you this, about 90% of all the churches organized today are not doing to even a small degree. I mean, maybe a token degree, but to 20-30% of what the first century church did for the people. You remember the church in the wilderness? That was the Levites and Israel and all that stuff. Now, our view of them is based on mostly what the Pharisees told us that the Torah meant. And like we've said many times before, there were other groups at the time of Jesus Christ, and certainly before him, 300 years before him, that interpreted the Torah completely different, read the same Hebrew, completely different interpretation of the Torah. And they were the most self-sufficient, most self-sustaining, and one of the few groups that really survived the Holocaust of the Roman destruction of Jerusalem. And they had many, many things in common with early Christian church, and probably were a major portion of the populace of the early Christian church. Now, even saying Christian church is deceptive because most people don't know what they were doing. They were actually creating a free society just like Israel was, filled with people that were free. They might live in Rome, they might live in Greece, but they were free people. So much so that even the word Christianity, when it was finally coined, referred to people who were Romaios, in possession of their rights. And we just don't know that history. It's just been deleted from our education. And there's a reason why. Because there is, if you actually knew what the first century church was doing in America, Australia, wherever you're at today, you would probably be a free people. But you're not, because you haven't been doing what they were doing. You've been doing something else. You've got this false religion that people say believe in Jesus, but they don't tell you what Jesus said to do or what Jesus was setting up. Because he goes and he takes these men aside and he trains them. He calls them disciples, which means students. And he trains them to be the ministers of this ecclesia, this called out group, to provide something for the people. Because he said, feed my sheep. You know, he asked Peter three times to feed him his sheep. And there's a reason why three times, is because he's feeding the people on several different levels, which is essential for a free society. If you just freed everybody in the world and said, everybody's free, you don't have to pay taxes anymore, you're not bound by government contracts, you know, you can do whatever you want, you know, and it'd be total chaos. Because they'd also have to say, well, you're not going to get any benefits, we're not going to give out any welfare, we're not going to give out any free education, you know, no public schools, we're not going to give you any of those benefits of government. You're just going to have to do like we did 200 years ago. People had to put up their own food. And, you know, we've talked about this many times. Pilgrims. Jamestown. They said, everybody works. And we take all the food and we put it in a storehouse. And then we share it equally with everybody's need. Starved every year. Never could produce enough. Both settlements at the same time, without any coaching from anybody else, just collectively through the mysteries of the universe, suddenly decided to each according to what he produces. In other words, what you produce, private property. What you produce is yours. It's yours, period. It belongs to you. You put it in the storehouse, you put it in your own house, you put it in a larder, you're responsible. We're not going to have a common storehouse. You're going to have to produce your own food. Starvation ended. Hunger ended. Everybody who said, this is all I can do, I just can't work any harder, suddenly, they worked harder. Because if they didn't put up the food, there wasn't going to be any food. And there was a surplus. Every year there was a surplus. No starvation. Ended, period. That's it. Gone. Not a bit. Well, now we've moved back to the common storehouse. We don't have necessarily a common storehouse, but everybody has to, you know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his want. It's not even his need, it's just what he wants. You know, because a lot of people could work and don't, and a lot of people could apply themselves better and don't, because you get welfare if you're poor. If you don't have enough money, we'll give it to you. Now, that of course is insane. You'd have to be a psychotic to think that you could get away with that, knowing human nature. But they've done it. They've done it in Australia. They've done it in America. They've done it in Europe. And, you know, I mean, they have 70, 80% income tax in places like that. And nobody produces enough children to even man the factories for tomorrow, so they have to import immigrants. It's like they're committing suicide. But there was a gigantic demonstration in France the other day. I mean, it was huge. I mean, I saw pictures of it. It was a little while ago, but it wasn't that long ago. But this huge demonstration, and there's a huge square, and you know, roads going this way and that way, and there was just people everywhere. I mean, it wasn't like there was a space of cement that you could put another person. All protesting the ineffectiveness of the government, the ineffectiveness of the economy, the violence from immigrants. I mean, they were just protesting that the government's not doing a good job. But they don't know what it's supposed to be doing. I mean, they have their wants. They're looking to government to solve the problem that the government created. But the government created it because the people created the government, and the people created the government because the people were already the problem. And the problem was is the people are slothful in the ways of law, judgment, mercy, and faith. The weightier matters. They're slothful in the weightier matters. They don't really care about their neighbor. Well, they might care about their few neighbors, you know, right next door and stuff, but they don't care about the people down the street. That's a block away. You know, I mean, somebody can be unjustly treated and, you know, it's none of my business. And, of course, this is just magnified because of the fact that the people think, hey, the government can do this. Why don't they do that? They could probably do that better than me. I mean, people were violently opposed to public education. Most people were educated outside of public school, and only the poorest of the poor of the poor went to public school. I mean, they had public school in Boston. Early on, even Madison said, well, we should have some kind of public school. He was wrong, but he said we should have some kind of public school for the absolute indigent. Now, he said that once. There were other times when he thought, no, well, it should be privately supported by free will offerings. It might be public in the sense that the government was already beginning to claim land that nobody was on yet, and said, you know, that we're claiming all this kind of like for the king, and when you get on it, then we'll let you have a legal title. Part of the Revolutionary War was fought because people did not want anybody to settle for a legal title. They wanted them to actually own the land so the land could not be taxed. Because if you own the land, it couldn't be taxed. The mere sight that you can be taxed on your land is because you don't own it. I mean, if you don't pay the taxes for 2 years, they take the whole land away from you, and they sell it in most states and don't give you anything back. Because you never owned it to begin with. You had a legal title, but the legal title doesn't include the ownership of the property. Did you know that? That's in the definition. I'm not making it up. So we don't know these things, but we also don't know how to operate in a free society if we were suddenly given a free society. Because if you suddenly let everybody free, they'd be killing each other in a day. You know, in a week or a month, they'd be eating each other. I mean, it would just be mass hysteria. If the trucks all rolled on time, you know, it might go on for a month or two. But what if you were to shut down the power? You just turned off the power in the United States, EMP, CME, some sort of natural disaster or unnatural disaster, cut off all the power. They say that 90% of you would be dead before the first year. Cannibalism would be widespread. Murder and mayhem everywhere. There's a spirit of anger growing up. And we talked in the last show about symbols of ancient times and how they keep appearing and reappearing. We talked about the fact that there seems to be a collective consciousness. Studies, you know, you can go back and listen to the recordings. The studies that are have been going on for decades now show that if the collective thinking of the people is concentrated and focused, you know, like a major disaster or something, that focusing of their attention alters the physical environment. They actually can register a change in the physical environment simply because everybody's thinking a particular way or a particular way of thinking. That's the physical environment. The mental environment is extremely affected. This is why you get mass hysteria. We're looking forward to see, you know, a breakdown in society where there is mass hysteria and there will be mass murder. There's no way an individual can prepare for what's coming. We all, you know, giving and taking a marriage and doing, you know, our own thing and thinking nothing's really going to happen. I mean, you know, there might be some sort of depression and there's probably going to be another run at inflation and, you know, they'll probably elect somebody who might try to get your guns. I mean, all these things, but you don't realize that we're talking way serious repercussions. The early church saw the same thing taking place in Rome. Runaway inflation, you know, a sack of wheat going from, you know, 6 denarii to 120,000 denarii. I mean, it's just unaffordable. You can't even buy a sack of wheat. Thousands upon thousands of people starving, disease rampant in the cities. People fleeing the cities. Cities emptying out. 90% of their population disappeared into the countryside, not all to survive at the breakdown of Rome. And Rome was not nearly as interdependent as you are today. You know, a lot of those people could still do things that, you know, they had a fairly primitive agricultural economy, but they could get back into that economy rather quickly. Today, I was just driving a tractor this morning and a pin came loose. Just one pin. Can't move the tractor anymore. You know, fuel runs out, can't move it anymore. Millions would starve. Power goes out, millions will starve. Somebody cuts the power, millions upon millions will starve. And many of them will not starve quietly. So they'll be stealing food. And you know, one of the major problems with starvation and famine isn't the fact that there isn't enough food for the people. It's that people hoard it. People steal it. People waste it. You know, I was just shocked when I found out when we were taking tons and tons of thousands of tons of grain to India during the famines way back in the 50s and 60s. And the reality is they were producing enough food to feed all their people every year. They just weren't sharing it. They were distributing it abroad, but they weren't sharing it, you know, because they only wanted to sell it. They didn't want to feed the poor. They didn't care about the poor. So Americans sent grain over there. And then there was a complaint about that because it was keeping the price of grain down, and the farmers who were producing grain wanted to produce it at a higher price, and they weren't getting a higher price because Americans were dumping their free grain, paid for by tax dollars. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And the news media doesn't really report all this stuff because the news media is controlled. And we used to have years and years and years of supply of grain on hand in this country in silos at any given time, but today we don't have hardly any. Worldwide, we have less than 30 days supply of grain, maybe 45 in a good year. So what was the church doing, the church in the wilderness, the early church? It was organizing the people in a way that they could take care of themselves. And, of course, the people that were attracted to the church were self-starting, self-sacrificing, self-motivated individuals with a high degree of moral character. High by today's standards, certainly. And what the church was a system of voluntary charity that helped take up the slack, so if there wasn't enough food here, they could move it over, which we see right away in the Acts of the Apostles, they're doing. They're taking food to an area where there is a dearth and supplies and helping them out. And Galatia is sending money, and Corinth is sending money and supplies, and they're doing this back and forth whenever there's a need. And that balance, we show you in the first century and second century church meetings, they say we gather every week, and those that have share with those that don't have enough. And that was written to Antonius Pius, who was the emperor of Rome, because they were explaining to him why we don't join your social welfare system run through the temples, which we call pagan temples. We think it's some certain, you know, place where they go and, you know, they go, you know, got dancing girls and bow down to, you know, some sort of statue. No, they were practical systems of social welfare. They funded it by forcing contributions from the people based on income. But this divided the people and made them, it made them fit for nothing but bondage. That's what Roman historians tell you. Roman historians before and after Christ tell you that the socialist system created depravity amongst the people. They lived on their laurels for a while, paying for grain and feed and aid, but eventually it didn't work. It wasn't enough. And people starved. And people said, we got to do something different. And so Constantine said, well, why don't you all try it the way the Christians do it, through charity. Of course, he funded the church that he started, because they didn't require necessarily the high degree of morality. They only required that you be a good member of that church. And eventually they required that everybody be a member of that church. And that's what's happened, because see, your social welfare system is your religion. That's what religion meant. Religion was the performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. So whatever you did for the welfare of society, because your duty is to take care of the needy of your society, whatever you did to do that was religion. And because Christians wouldn't join the religion of Rome, which depended upon forced offerings, you know, you had to pay in according to how much you made. Because they wouldn't join that, they were persecuted. To the point in Africa and in the Roman Empire in generally, they outlawed private religion, which Christianity was a private religion based on faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty. The people who are Christians understood how that worked. Christians today have not got a clue. So the question was presented in the last part of the last show that we did earlier today. What does a minister of the church established by Christ basically do? What's his duties? What kind of role does he play in this free society that survived and thrived during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire? What was his duties? What was he doing? Well, he's not forcing people to give to him. He does have a moral standard. We have that in the Ten Commandments, you know, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. take care of your family, take care of your parents, you know, I mean, so that their days will be long upon the land, and so that your days will be long upon the land, because your kids will see you taking care of your parents, and they'll realize that, oh, we got to take care of our parents, and it will become customary in your family. Today, it's customary in your family to turn them over to social welfare, Social Security, you know, Medicare, Medicaid. They're the ones who take care of them. But that isn't what Moses was doing. That isn't what Christ was doing. That's not what the church in the wilderness was doing. It's not what the church established by Christ was doing. It's what the churches today do. They send their members to benefactors to exercise authority. If you actually need something, like help, and so what is the minister supposed to be doing? What's his duties? If he's going to practice, he's going to be the minister of private religion, private welfare. A welfare that binds people together, that helps them come together, because it binds them emotionally, because people helped me out when I was sick and I didn't even know some of these people. So when you're better, you'll want to contribute, we hope. But we can only hope, because we can't make you like the other governments of the world. We're not that kind of government. So when we say his church, we're talking about one form of government that does not use force, like John the Baptist. Till John the Baptist, everybody used force to get the money to provide for the welfare of the people. But John the Baptist said, no, if you got extra, share with those that don't have enough. That simple. So what does the minister do? He facilitates that sharing in a way that people are not left behind. So 10 families get together, and they get together and number themselves as together with this small group, 10 families. And that minister, it's his job to receive their offerings and put it out back into the system of charity, the welfare of society, in a way to help others. So that those who have share with those that don't have enough. Now, they have a moral standard that you're not supposed to be lazy. You're supposed to attend to the weightier matters. That you're supposed to be honest, etc., etc., etc. You're not supposed to be committing adultery. You're not supposed to be stealing. You're supposed to be taking care of your family. They see that. And that's what they want to be a part of. And that's what they are a part of. Because they're Christians. They're followers of Christ, followers of Moses, because Christ and Moses were in agreement. The Pharisees weren't that way. They had established a system of Corban based on forced offerings under Herod the Great, and therefore their Corban, their sacrifice, was making the word of God to none effect. So the duty of the church minister, his church, who's the minister of 10 families, is to connect those families with 9 other groups of families just like them. They get to know those families, they get to know the ministers of those families, and they help them out. And they hear that somebody over here needs a little help, and they make a decision as to whether they're going to send some funds to him. Every week they get some funds in, and they send the funds back out. Most of them, they keep some on reserve for, you know, a rainy day, the same as everybody. You know, you're going to town, you say, I want to need $20 and for gas and lunch and everything. But you might take, you know, an extra couple 20s in case you need more. That's just common sense. I mean, if I put up wood for the winter, I put up enough for the whole winter. If you put in a garden, you don't just put in a garden to eat, which is, you know, for June, July, August, and September. You also put up enough for October, November, December, January, February, and March. At least till April. Maybe till May. Because you got to have enough to get you all the way through. We don't understand that now, because we just go to the store. So we don't think in those terms. But Christians had to think in those terms. So how does that all work? It works through charity. And that it requires daily sacrifice, a daily ministration of to the needy of your society. And that's what they were doing. the early church ministers, that's what they're doing. So the question also was, what's the duties of a minister of his church and a minister, an ordained minister of his holy church? Well, his holy church, the apostles were a part of his holy church. They, like Christ, if they had been rich, they become poor. And we can show you this throughout history. In other words, everything they own, they give up, and they hold it in common. But they have a duty to perform, a religious duty to perform to society. They are the overseers of this network of giving. They don't have a big, gigantic vault somewhere that thieves and robbers can break in. You know, they don't have a Fort Knox where all the money goes in and they just keep piling it up for that rainy day. No, it's piled up in your pockets. There's no golden calf that we make, you know, and secure behind a vaulted door. The kingdom of heaven is where your treasure is. That's in the relationship you have with all the people. Now, it's not an emotional relationship like you have with many churches where everybody gets together and they're emotionally bonded with each other. It's not that kind of a relationship. It's a relationship of righteousness. You're supposed to seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness, not the emotional attachment. You know, the camaraderie. Now, that will come. But what you're seeking is to tend to the weightier matters of righteousness. And so that these ministers are facilitating this. You got 10 ministers for each, you know, one for each family group. So that's 100 families. And then he gets together with ministers. So then that 100 becomes 1,000. And 1,000 becomes 10,000. You have all those people that are sharing through this network of communication to help out the needy of your society. And that brings people together because they know that these guys didn't have to help me, and they did. My son was once in an office, Social Security office, and there was somebody ahead of him, and they were ranting and raving and screaming and yelling and complaining, and it was a young guy. And he evidently was on Social Security, and he was getting a Social Security check. He was there with his girlfriend and their baby. But he was a heroin addict, so therefore he gets on Social Security. Because he can't work because he's a heroin addict. He doesn't get clean and go get a job. He just stays on methadone. And he just keeps taking the methadone. And I can't work because, you know, I've got to take my drugs. And that's what the system is paying for. Because you don't have to be morally good. See, I did a whole show on Australia, the whole history of their welfare system. Most of their welfare was taken care of by the church, and then suddenly they decided, let's help the church out with government money. Let's force our neighbors to contribute some funds, put it in a big treasury that the government has control of, and the government will be the benevolent benefactor of the people, exercising authority over them, forcing them to contribute so that nobody's left behind. And then we will accumulate this wealth and we will dole it out and we will take over so that churches don't have to be charitable anymore. They don't have to take care of the needy. We'll do it for them. But such welfare is a snare. And it binds you. And the countries go into debt in order to provide it. And you keep doing it anyway. Even though I can show you history, century after century after century, that wise men said, no, you can't do it that way. It will destroy society. But you're oblivious to that today. And oblivious to a lot more. So what the church is people trying to get back to that free, voluntary society that where people take care of one another. And the fact is they're not going to really get good at it until things get really bad. But things are starting to get really bad. So you should be working at it. Just building the connections. And start seeking that kingdom of God and the righteousness of taking care of one another by faith, hope, and charity rather than force, fear, and violence. Most of Christian churches, most Jewish synagogues have chosen to use force, fear, and violence because they ask the government, the benefactors who exercise authority, the gods many of the world, you take care of this for me. And it just doesn't work that way. So, anyway, we're going to need to take a break. And we'll come back and we'll start talking about some of these symbols that keep reappearing, some of these personalities that keep reappearing throughout history, and exactly how that plays into it so that you can move away from the psychosis of society towards the reasonable, the right reason of society. But anyway, we'll do that when we come back from this break. So welcome back. How do you recognize whether or not you're headed towards this society that operates by faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty, where you will gather together with other people that even though you're not necessarily all going to go to the same neighborhood, you want to be a widespread network. And you want to blend into society. You don't all want to wear straw hats and 3-inch suspenders. You want to fit into society, but realize that there is another consciousness that isn't a sociopathic consciousness or a psychopathic consciousness or a narcissistic consciousness, because those mindsets are what is everybody else's doing. I mean, a narcissist, the personality of a narcissist, as we define that term today, is usually considered to be a disorder. And it's from the Greek mythology of an individual who fell in love with their own reflection. And Freud used the term to describe a person who was self-absorbed. Psychoanalysis have focused on narcissists' need to bolster his or her self-esteem through grandiose fantasies, exaggerated ambitions and exhibitions, and feeling of entitlement. Now, this is somebody who has this whole disorder. You don't have to have all those things to be manifesting elements of narcissism, and that's a psychopath. You know, there's a definition for psychopath as well. A narcissist are often unaware of what they are doing. They do have feelings, but their feelings are not empathetic feelings. While they are manipulative, it is largely a subconscious state. They don't realize that they're narcissists. And most of your presidents are narcissists. There's been numerous psychologists that come forward and talk about the present president as being extremely narcissistic in his speeches and everything, because he's very self-absorbed. But he's very popular, very smooth talker. And is well liked by lots of people. Now, why is that? Narcissists are often very charming, but they actually don't care about anybody else but themselves. They will use up people and waste people. Now, again, there are many different levels of this, and you don't necessarily have to have all these characteristics. But this is actually describing, this narcissism is actually describing a spiritual personality. And when you have that spiritual personality, you draw spiritual entities, societies, whatever, of that similar nature. you draw that person. You draw those kinds of people. And that's why we have lots of narcissists in society today. We certainly have a lot of people that think they are entitled. You see, remember that? That's part of the definition. That they have this exaggerated ambition and very exhibitionist, you know, they look in their mirror, you know, I mean, weightlifters and people who, you know, get all toned up and want to see themselves in the mirror and manage to get their shirt off. They have this feeling of entitlement that other people owe them, that they're better. But this psychopath is always a conscious individual, has some of the same traits, but he's very conscious of it, can be very manipulative of other people with an actual strategy. The other one just kind of does it and expects it because he has this feeling of entitlement. They all need to have a feeling of control of their reality, and therefore they will want to control other people. Now, again, when we're talking about this sociopath mentality or a narcissistic mentality, I mean, one of the major differences is that the narcissist doesn't realize it and the sociopath does. But but the key thing is that these characteristics can show up in a lot of people that aren't necessarily so far gone that you would say they have the disorder. But the tendency to move in that direction is there. And when you have extreme situations in society, people will slide over into those personalities more and more and more. They will act, it's like being caught in a current of narcissism. They create this, you know, it's a personality disorder from the point of view of a psychologist, but from a spiritual point of view, there you're going to be dragged over into all these characteristics under in times of extreme emotional trauma. And most narcissists are the result of trauma. I give you a story of a narcissist. An extreme case. I mean, this guy ended up murdering numerous people and got away with it, and was able to blame other people for the murder, got them arrested and put into jail. And people thought, oh, this guy didn't murder because he was very charming and he didn't seem like a murderer, didn't seem guilty, he didn't do anything to give himself away. But he was a murderer. Well, why did he become a murderer and the other guy not? And what happens to turn him over to this psychotic behavior where he actually kills people? And eventually he was captured. His last murder, he had broke into a motel room and beat a man unconscious, knocked him out, and kidnapped his wife, probably to abuse her and then kill her. Because there's evidence that he, evidently there was a string of dead people throughout his life. And the husband woke up in the motel room and evidently had a gun somewhere and got his gun out of the pack or bags and came out to rescue his wife. It's broad daylight. And he charged at the guy, and the guy had a gun. That's how he held the guy at bay to begin with. And the guy's trying to save his wife, but tried to shoot at the guy, and he shot the husband and eventually just stood there and killed him. But he was wounded, so he ended up having to look for medical help, and eventually the cops caught him. And all daylight and people survived. I mean, the husband died, but the wife survived and other witnesses survived. So we know this is the guy who was shooting the guy. But when the cop was interviewing him, he said, what about the husband, Jeff? I don't remember what his name was. Jeff. Yeah, and the narcissist said, Jeff, yeah, that guy was crazy. I mean, he was insane. He was just coming after me. He was trying to kill me. He was trying to kill me. He says, well, you just beat him unconscious and kidnapped his wife. Yeah, but the guy was trying to kill me. Yeah, but don't you see that the guy was defending his, trying to save his wife? No, man, this guy, you don't understand. This guy was trying to kill me. He was coming after me. He just kept coming. I shot him and he just kept coming. That guy was crazy. He was insane. This is what the narcissist is saying. He doesn't seem to understand. He thinks he's entitled to kill this man. He thinks he's entitled to take his wife. He'd killed cops before. He'd killed people in the military before. And all this was uncovered when they started going back in his life and found out that he had led a string of bodies behind. Usually other people got blamed for it because nobody could believe that this guy was actually this psychotic murderer. But he was just an extreme case of narcissist. How did he get that way? What happened to him? Was he born that way? Well, some suggest that maybe he was. But some suggest that there was a trauma in his life. His own brother drowned in a pool when he was like 2 years old and he was 4 years old. And he was alone with him in the backyard and his brother ended up drowning. Traumatic event. People crying, weeping, everybody feeling bad. To remember that, he couldn't even remember that. He didn't ever have any recollection of it. It was just completely like out of his brain. He did when it was brought up, he doesn't remember it, but it's historically, it was a reality. Why didn't he remember it? It's too painful to remember. So the part of his brain that had that information in it, he shut off. He just shut down. He just doesn't look there anymore. And now anything to do with murder that he may have caused or been attributing to the cause, he has no conscience about it. Because the part of his brain that is connected to the part of him that would stimulate remorse and empathy, sadness, that's gone. It's disconnected. Pulled the plug. So he just repeats that in his life over and over again. These people who kill, 27 people and bury them under their, and under their house, kill kids and eat people and all these macabre things. These are extremes, but the same process can take place in you on a much more subtle level. You don't have to kill somebody, but you can abuse somebody. You could take a bite out of somebody. And see, that's what's happened in society. We all think we're entitled to public education. We think we're entitled to social. You can explain to them that Social Security is bankrupt, it's been bankrupt for years. It's not an insurance program. The money was never put on deposit for later on. It's dependent upon taking money from somebody who's now working to feed the people who are now retired to provide for them. And it's based on force. It's not based on love. Nobody's giving that money in because they love you. They're giving that money in because they have to. And when they need money, they expect the government to force other people to give more money. And if you end up with a baby boomers where there's more people collecting than paying in, they just want you to pay more. I paid in, you have to pay in. So what if you have to pay more? So what if you have to go into debt to do it? I paid in, I want my, because they don't care. They have no empathy. They don't care about their children and their grandchildren. They just want to be taken care of now. I paid in, you guys have to pay in too. It's not love binding your society together. It's narcissism. It's a feeling of entitlement. You're entitled. You bet on this horse, it lost, they've squandered the money, thieves and robbers broke in, they depleted the treasury, but you don't care, you want to force other people to provide for you. Now, I talked earlier in another show about a guy giving a seminar, charging $300 for the weekend, to tell you that it's not your fault, it's the New World Order's fault, or it's the Pope's fault, or it's the Illuminati's fault, or it's somebody else's fault. It's not your fault. They did this to you. Those fraudsters, those those cheats, those banksters, those liars. It's their fault. It's not your fault. And so people will pay them $300 on a weekend, get 100 people. What is that, $30,000? Cool. For a weekend of talking to them, telling them it's not your fault, it's the New World Order's fault. It's the banker's fault. And then, you know, you can go get, you know, some sort of cyber currency and fill out these papers and then you'll be somehow free. It won't happen, but this is what they tell you. People just eat that up and they pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Evidently, the course is normally $1,850 a piece. But he's going to give this special deal for $300 and everybody can go and listen to him. Wow. Because he's going to tell you that it's somebody else's fault. Now, if I put on a seminar, which we'll have a seminar. We actually come to the Burning Bush Festival. It's like a seminar. And I'll talk all day. I'll talk you into the ground. I'll explain things. I'll use a, you know, dry eraser board. And I'll draw you graphs. And I'll explain to you exactly how the system works. All our books are free already online. You can download them all. Covenants of the Gods, how you're brought in, how the what should have been for your welfare has become a snare. We show you that step by step. People have read that book over and over again. They say, every time I read it, I discover something new because it's just packed full of stuff. Thy Kingdom Come shows you how societies throughout history have developed voluntary societies that set people free and save people when those non-voluntary societies eventually self-destruct. Tells you how they've done it in the past. Free Church Report tells you how you can do it now. You just need ministers who are actually doing real service for the people. Because see, church services today is just like the guy who's got the seminar for $300. They're just going to tell you that you're good, that God loves you, that you're saved because you thought a thought and you said this phrase. And so, but if you actually get hungry, if you fall off a ladder, can't work, and your kids are hungry, they're not going to feed you. They're going to send you to the government. Well, churches didn't used to do that, but that's what they do now. Because their church service is not really service. It's just a feel-good thing. They're just there to make you feel good. You know, tickle your ears, make you feel good. Church, real church service, real ministers of the church established by Jesus Christ actually received the offerings of the people and those that had shared with those that didn't have enough through these ministers. And some of those ministers took what they received and went out into the streets and found the people who couldn't make it because maybe they, you know, they were sick, they were ill, they were elderly, whatever. And he made sure that they got what they needed to get them through. And they shared. And this created bonds in society. And it really worked. And they survived the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. When they had to leave a particular town because it just got too bad in that town. You know, there were towns with 100,000 people. In less than a few days, the population in these towns went from 100,000 to less than 10,000. In a few days. Where did those people go? They had to get out of town. There wasn't even food. You remember when the Russians, or the Germans were attacking the Russians in Stalingrad and they were fighting back and forth. And the people said they knew they were out of grain in the city because the rats were everywhere. Because there wasn't even grain for the rats. And so you could catch rats and people ate the rats that had previously been eating the grain because there was no grain anymore. It was just gone. It was all used up. There wasn't even anything for the mice and the rats to eat, so the people ate the rats. That's how bad it got. And it got worse than that during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire on a regular basis. Armies were going around surviving, but you know they're just stripping farms and what have you, and you know, but they did have still a system around so that they could take funds from here and there, and they would send troops to, you know, gather grain and give IOUs, and we saw the same thing you know, during the Soviet Union's, during the famines that took place there, where Stalin gathered up even the seed grain, so they didn't even have anything to plant, and people just starved left and right. But Christians survived. Real Christians, not during that famine, but during the fall of the Roman Empire, survived and thrived because they had a network. If they had to leave town, they had a whole network of people all over the country that they could go to. They could travel light. I remember once climbing Mount Whitney, and we were at about 13,800 feet. And we were going across this, a long trail. We'd already crossed the glacier, so there was no more snow right where we were at. And you could see over the rim, and you could see the glacier down there, the in the snowpack. And you'd see people edging along. There were still some people climbing below us. And there was one guy who was just cooking. He was just hauling. He was just moving. You could see him on the trail. He was just a little dot, but he was moving. And we thought, who is that guy? You know, everybody else is carrying packs. That guy wasn't carrying a pack. He was going like John Muir. He was just making tracks. He was from, I believe he was from Australia, but he could have been from New Zealand. It's been a long time now. But he was traveling light, and he could travel fast. And he was going up, and he was going down the same day. He wasn't bringing any packs or anything. And he was in good shape, but because he wasn't carrying anything, he could make better time. Well, see, Christians could do that when they left Jerusalem. They didn't have to carry anything. They left everything behind. But that was okay because they had this whole network all across Europe, up to Germany, down into Africa. All I had to do is contact somebody that wasn't in Jerusalem, that was outside of the network, and they would lead them through an underground of Christians all across Europe, and they would find another place, and they would survive. And then they would help others survive. But the guys who just get their little buddies together, if they get overrun, they're done. Nobody's going to take them in anywhere else. Who cares about them? They didn't care about anybody else. They didn't want to form a network of people who actually put the idea of loving their neighbor as themselves primary in their life, tending to the weightier matters primary in their life. Sacrifice. They didn't come together to serve one another. They came together to feel good, to save themselves. That's why they came together, to save themselves. They're not interested in doing things according to the spiritual character of Christ. Maybe they're not narcissists. Maybe they're not sociopaths. But they're not like Christ. And we're going to go into narcissism quite in depth. And we could do the same thing with sociopaths and psychopaths and all that stuff. All these people are out of their minds. Actually, they're in their minds. They're in the tree of knowledge. More than you can even imagine. You know, Benjamin Franklin once said, "He who falls in love with himself will have no rivals." And of course, you know, Ben, he was kind of clever, and he probably stole that from somebody else. But it's true. But the reality is that if you're interested in saving yourself, I mean, the last thing you want to be is in a bunker with 10 other survivalists when the food runs out, because they're not there to save you. They're there to save themselves. That's the nature of them. So how do we get the nature of Christ? Because that's what you need. And this is one of the jobs of the minister. Now, he isn't by any power of his own going to be filtering out those people who are not Christ-like. But the more Christ-like he is, the more he can point by the light that's in him, will he reveal those people who will not really persevere until the end. Ultimately, the real test is in the time and the events of your life, as long or as short as it's going to be. But this was Christianity. This was the character of Christianity, was the character of Christ. people actually coming together to serve. They didn't come together because they wanted to feel good or they wanted to have a bunch of buddies and have their buddies all like them and they like their buddies. They were coming together to even to the point where they would sacrifice their own self for others. But how do you know those guys who come, they're hoping you'll sacrifice yourself for them while they themselves will not sacrifice themselves for you? How do you filter out those selfish, you know, the Judases? You know, Christ had a Judas right up to the last there. But eventually he betrayed Christ. So when you get together with your little group, how are you going to connect to other groups? Who are you going to know? I tell you, the same as these symbols are passed down from age upon age and they keep popping up where people didn't learn them. They just started drawing them. The same with personalities. And I gave the example. I might as well say it again. If you go watch all the video you can find on Mussolini. You know, both when he's not dressed up in his uniform, not giving a big speech, and when he's giving a big speech up on a balcony. And then go watch the speeches from Trump. Before he was running for president and now. And you're going to see some interesting characteristics. You know, we have some very lifelike statues of famous emperors, you know, like Caligula, Nero. Some of them have some of the same exact facial features as other presidents of the United States. Why is that? Why do they take on these personalities? Because they actually, you know, when they start taking on some of the personalities and you look at these, you know, we don't have videos of Caligula and Nero and all this stuff, but we do have those single, you know, snapshots and statues. But if you, I tell you that people will actually take on the physical characteristics of certain people. I could go into this in great depth with you and show you how this appears, but then I'm appealing to the logic of your mind so that you begin to believe that. That's not where we're going. I want you to begin to see these things yourselves. And that's why you need to gather together with other people that are beginning to see this, because you will begin to see more. But we're out of time today. So until we meet again, peace on your house. And may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.